We're going to take our inspiration from the book of Micah. So if you want to follow it, it's just a few verses. You're welcome to look those verses up in Micah chapter 7. They're the closing verses of the book, and I think they're at the end of the book for a very good reason. So Micah ends his book with these words, verse 18. Who is a God like you who pardons sin and forgives the transgression of the remnant of his inheritance? You do not stay angry forever, but delight to show mercy. You will again have compassion on us. You will tread our sins underfoot and hurl all our iniquities into the depths of the sea. You will be faithful to Jacob and show love to Abraham, as you pledged on oath to our ancestors in days long ago. Who is a God like you? Micah is overcome by God. He's just astonished and astounded and amazed and bemused by the power and the wonder and the sheer awesomeness of God. So the book finishes with these words. Not sure if Micah put the book together or if the book was put together by someone after he died who took all his writings and sermons and put them in this order. That much we don't know. But these words are at the end for a reason. Because these verses sum up Micah's life. When I was a student, I was a physics student at the time, my pastor, when he learned of my call to overseas cross-cultural mission, he gave me a book as a present. It was called A Bunch of Everlastings, by F.W. Borum. And in it, Borum tries to tell people's lives through a Bible verse. He chooses a Bible verse which best sums up this person's life. And since reading that book, it kind of haunts me. And actually, there is a Bible verse. I won't tell it to you now, but there is a Bible verse that sums up my life. And if I were to have a gravestone, which I'm not, you could put it on the gravestone. But this is Micah's life story in these verses. And at the heart of it, really, is a sermon that he preached. Now, I don't know what Bible verse. Actually, it's an interesting one. You can spend the week thinking what Bible verse would sum up my life. It's a great, great exercise to do. Wonderful, as you look back on God's blessings down the years. But this is based, all comes from a sermon that Micah preached around about 710 BC, give or take 5 years. And I preached on these verses one evening in mid-September in 2004. You remember that, don't you, all of you? And, of course you don't remember it. I don't expect you to remember it, and I'm not the least bit hurt that you don't. But suppose The sermon that I preached that day in September in 2004 changed the destiny, changed the whole nation. Suppose my sermon that evening had saved our nation from destruction. You might remember it then. You might remember it then. And Micah's sermon, in my humble opinion, is one of the five great sermons of the Bible. My list, Sermon on the Mount, obviously, you know, has to go number one. Micah's sermon, there's Ezra's sermon in Jerusalem, when they built a little pulpit in the town square. There's Moses' sermon, choose you this day who you'll follow. And there's Peter's sermon on the day of Pentecost. I think the five, I thought maybe that would be a good thing to put on. I'm not media, social media savvy, but I was thinking maybe asking Magnus if he could put like clickbait for Penrouch, you know, the five greatest sermons in the Bible will astonish you, and see how many hits we get, how many people turn up at our service because of what they've seen on the internet. I'm just a dinosaur, really. That's beyond me. But anyway, that's what I thought we could do. The five great sermons of the Bible. This is one of them. And it's just really three things his sermon taught him and which sums up his life. And the first is so simple. God forgives. Cannot put it simpler than that. God forgives. Recently, someone asked us if our children were adopted. I don't know why they asked us that. They're not, but if they had been, that's fine, not a problem. But that kind of kicked my mind into thinking, because I was just looking at a verse in the Bible where the Apostle Paul talks to us about adoption. In Ephesians 1, verse 5, he talks about God adopting us. And adoption wasn't very common in Jewish culture, but it was very common in Roman culture and in Greek culture. So the word he uses for adoption is quite a technical word, quite a legal word. I do know it, but I get my tongue twisted around my teeth when I try to pronounce it, so I'm not even going to bother. But it's a technical term for adoption, because in the Roman world, it was amazing what happened with when people adopted somebody. It could be a man or a woman they adopted, a boy or a girl. But that brought about a number of huge changes in that person's life. Firstly, they changed their name. They were given a new name in their family. They were given a new identity. Just imagine a new passport, new driving license, everything. Because you have been adopted, all that changes. They became members of the new family, and they became heirs to the family fortune. It didn't matter if there were natural children in the family. Their right was equal to the natural children's rights. They gained the rights to inherit the family fortune. And this is a point I was getting. One of the other things they received was their debts were forgiven. That maxed out Visa card, that struggling MasterCard, your debts are wiped out when you're adopted in the Roman and Greek society. And that's what Paul's saying. When we're adopted, God takes us into his family and we become new people. We become new name, a new identity, and our debts are wiped out. And that is just the most wonderful feeling. I did show that when I was in this church many, many years ago, I did show a clip from the film Angela's Ashes. I looked for it recently, I couldn't find it. But it's my favorite clip from the film, and it's one of my favorite film clips of all time. It's an autobiography of a man called Frank McCourt, brought up in a poor family in Ireland. His father was a hopeless alcoholic. They went to America, and his father was so bad looking after the family, the Irish community clubbed together and sent them back to Ireland. As he says, the only family went the other way at that time. And he struggled through miserable poverty in Ireland. And at one point, as his teenager, he gets a job for the local moneylender keeping her books for her. She's a terrible woman. She's merciless and pitiless and gives no quarter. And he is her bookkeeper. And then one day he goes into work and he finds that she has died in the night of natural causes. So he goes to the ledger where all the debts are written, and he steals the ledger. He takes the ledger away, and he takes that ledger with all its debts down to the River Shannon. And in the film, he looks through the book. He says, all the names are here. My mum, £2 for Christmas. Aunt Aggie, £9. Maybe for my post office clothes. Bridie Hannon for ointment for Mr. Hannon's legs. Mrs. Purcell, Cloacy, Quigley, Molloy, everyone I know and half of the poor of Limerick are here. They all owed her money. And then he hurls the ledger into the River Shannon. He says, but not anymore. God forgives. That is what God has done for me. Micah has exactly the same picture, and it's not the River Shannon, it's the depths of the sea. You will hurl all our iniquities into the depths of the sea. They're gone, forgiven, because Jesus Christ died on the cross to carry our sins. Our debts are gone, and they're gone forever. No one will ever find them. So Micah discovered that God forgives, but he discovered that God forgives a nation. How about that? He's known as Micah of Moresheth. Moresheth was a tiny town on the borders of the Philistine country. He hated the big cities. He hated Jerusalem and he hated Samaria. But he had to go there sometimes. He had a good friend in the city, Isaiah, another prophet. And the two of them were very close. And they ministered together to the nation. But it did mean, I just always imagine Micah trudging up the road with a sack full of pomegranates or cabbages or leeks or whatever he's going to give to Mrs. Isaiah to cook the tea. I don't know if that's what happened, but he trudged. His heart used to sink as he got closer to Jerusalem because of its corruption, because of the pride and arrogance of the rich, because of the injustices, because of the difficulty the poor found in getting justice in the courts. The way the rich just accumulated wealth and accumulated property, and the poor got poorer and poorer. And I don't know how fed up you are with your own nation on a scale of 1 to 10. I don't even dare ask. And one thing that really got Micah annoyed were the religious people. He's not alone there. The religious people in Jerusalem used to annoy Jesus as well. They're the ones who really got him angry. They ones who should have known better. but they just behaved as if God didn't exist. In fact, Micah was so fed up with the religious people that in one of his sermons, he quotes this. I'm back in chapter 6 here, verse 6. With what shall I come before the Lord and bow down before the exalted God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams and 10,000 rivers of oil? Shall I offer my firstborn for my transgression, the first fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? All that's religion. He says, he has shown you, O mortal, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? Then he puts it in a nutshell. To act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with God. That's all he wants. Three things. Act justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God. And you can find all kinds of resonances to that in Jesus' sermons and teachings. At another time, you can do that. But then on one of his visits to Jerusalem, he gets to preach a sermon to King Hezekiah. And this is one of the greatest sermons ever preached. And we don't have it. We don't have a sermon. I just wish we did. We just have odd snippets from it, sheltered there in the midst of the book of Micah. And he preaches a sermon to Hezekiah. We do know that he said to Hezekiah this, because of the way this country has been run, because of the injustices, because of the fake religion, because of the dishonesty of people's hearts, Jerusalem is going to end up like a plowed field. And that resonated strongly because 100 miles or a bit more to the north, there were the remains of what had been the second greatest city of the area, Samaria, which about 6 years, 10 years before, had been flattened by the Assyrian army. Mighty city, flattened, and what was left of it, people stole from it. It had become a field, basically, on top of a hill. And Micah says, you just look at Samaria, because that's what's going to happen to this city because of you. And what was remarkable was that Hezekiah listened and said, you know what, Micah, you're right. And he set about all kinds of reforms, religious reforms, justice reforms, economic reforms. He put the nation right. And Jerusalem escaped destruction. That's another story for another time. But it was such a magnificent sermon that it was remembered 100 years later. Now, I don't imagine any of my sermons are remembered by next Sunday, but that's okay. This sermon was quoted 100 years later when another prophet was in deep trouble. The prophet was Jeremiah, and he's been preaching against all the corruption of the nation, and the king decided he really ought to kill Jeremiah. And Jeremiah's on trial for his life. And in Jeremiah chapter 26 and verse 16, the officials and the people said to the priests and the prophets, it's the religious people who are wanting to kill him, this man should not be sentenced to death. He has spoken to us in the name of the Lord our God. Some of the elders of the land stepped forward and said to the entire assembly of people, Micah of Moresheth prophesied in the days of Hezekiah, king of Judah. He told all the people of Judah, this is what the Lord Almighty says, Zion will be plowed like a field, Jerusalem will become a heap of rubble, the temple hill a mound overgrown with thickets. And that sermon, 100 years later, can be quoted off my heart by people because it was such a cracking sermon. And it changed the nation. And God forgave the nation. And another prophecy came true because of it. It was prophecies actually given to King Solomon. And the prophecy was this. He was in 2 Chronicles 7:14. If my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and I will forgive their sin and will heal their land. And God forgave the nation. So God forgives. God forgave the nation. And then God forgives all who believe in Jesus. Eugene Patterson said, there is no such thing as successful churches. There are instead communities of sinners gathered week by week in towns and villages all over the world. People who turn to God because they know that God forgives their sins. And we need it. And we're going to celebrate that around the communion table in just a moment or two. One of my favorite passages, some of you will have heard me quote it from time to time. I try not to overdo it. I have given instructions. I've asked to have this passage read at my funeral service. I'm pretty sure my family will ignore me. But it's from a man whose life had a huge impact on me, a man called Charles Haddon Spurgeon, lived long before my time, the great preacher of the 19th century. And by the time he was 21, like 10,000 people a night were crowding to hear him preach. And there's revival going on, and the church in Holyhead is Baptist Church in Holyhead is a result of this man's ministry and the revival under his preaching. But it all began for him on the 6th of January in 1850 when it snowed, and he couldn't get to his usual church. He was suffering from depression. And he was feeling miserable, and he was fed up with himself. And he felt that he was a sinner, and that nobody loved him, especially not God. But he couldn't get to church because of the snow, so he slipped into the first church he could find, which was a primitive Methodist church. And they were in trouble because the preacher hadn't turned up. So they commandeered one of their own to preach the sermon. The guy really was not a preacher, not a very good preacher, wasn't really a preacher at all. But he gave it his best shot. So he picked out of the Bible the text from Isaiah, Micah's friend, who says, "Look unto me and be ye saved, all the ends of the earth." And he begins by saying, anybody can look. It's a simple thing to look. All you got to do is look to Jesus. And then he kind of spins it out long. He says, look to Jesus. Jesus says, look to me, I'm dying on the cross for you. Look to me, I'm carrying your sins. Look to me, I'm rising from the dead. Look to me, I'm the Lord of lords and the King of kings. He strings this out for 10 minutes, at which point he's got nothing more to say. And he's groping, struggling for something to say, and he looks around and he sees Charles Spurgeon sat under the gallery. Never seen him before, obviously a visitor. So he turns to him and he says, "Young man, you look miserable." And Spurgeon writes, this is Spurgeon's own words, Dad, "Well, I did, but I had not been accustomed to have remarks made from the pulpit on my personal appearance before. However, it was a good blow, struck right home." He continued, "And you always will be miserable. Miserable in life and miserable in death if you don't obey my text. But if you obey now, this moment you'll be saved." Then, lifting up his hands, he shouted, as only a primitive Methodist could do, "Young man, look to Jesus Christ. Look, look, look. You have nothing to do but to look and live. I saw at once the way of salvation. I know not what else he said. I didn't take much notice of it. I was so possessed with that one thought. And I looked. I had been waiting to do 50 things, but when I heard that word, look, what a charming word it seemed to me. Oh, I looked until I could almost have looked my eyes away. There and then, the cloud was gone. The darkness had rolled away. At that moment, I saw the sun as I looked to Jesus. God forgives. And like the primitive Methodist preacher, I've run out of words. That's all I've got to say. God forgives. Just allow me to quote a verse from a hymn written about 1917 by a Nazarene pastor called Frederick Lehman. The hymn is not sung anymore. But the third verse is often quoted. Could we with ink the ocean fill, and were the skies of parchment made, and every stalk on earth a quill, and every man a scribe by trade, to write the love of God above would drain the oceans dry. Nor could that scroll contain the whole, though stretched from sky to sky. Who is a God like you? The God who pardons.